Napoleon the pig was said to have said, "All animals are created equal, but some are created more equal than others." If such is indeed the case, we simply must ask, which bird that preys is the most equal of all?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1308th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Santiago who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, there are 557 species of birds that prey. Each of these species has found a unique way to get along in nature. Carl Linnaeus, who went about organizing just about everything in nature, organized all the birds into orders, genera, and species. He then placed all the birds that prey into a single order, which he called
Accipitridae.
Okay. No wonder I can't say it. At any rate, that's what he did, and then subdivided this group into four genera: vultures, eagles and hawks and falcons, owls and shrikes. And then, of course, there are the different species of birds that prey, like the golden bald eagles, of which there are reported 60 flying around the world. These birds that prey also go by the name raptor, which, if you think about it, comes with a little bit of an edge. Raptor. Raptors are birds that hunt, kill, and eat vertebrate animals that are comparatively large relative to the birds themselves. Maybe that's why raptor comes with a bit of an edge to it. Or maybe it was that Jurassic Park movie or the military's new fighter jet. Of late, we the people seem to have taken a liking to raptors, as we have wolves, lions, and bears. We seem to like that which is wild. I think it's because they are wild and free, and we're not. And so raptors are wild and free leads us to the essential question of the day, which is, can we foster birds that are wild and free amidst all of our civilization? Well, who better to ask than Dr. Zeke Glucks, who is the director of Predatory Bird Research Group at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Dr. Zeke, welcome to the Food Chain Radio program.
Thanks so much for having me, Michael.
Well, so why do birds of prey demand our attention the way they do? I mean, we could be driving down the road and we could see a hawk perched on a pole and we slam on the brakes and we sit there and look at it.
What is it about them? I mean, I've fallen for them as well, so I'm definitely biased, but I do find that they're an excellent sort of gateway animal for folks to start looking at wildlife. I think it's because, like you say, they're large. They are, charismatic. They're always doing interesting things, chasing after other birds and each other. And they've really become a symbol, as you say, of wildness and independence. And I think we've sort of latched onto that as a society.
I've done a lot of radio shows with people who are fond of wolves and grizzly bears and other things that are very wild. And we all seem to gravitate toward that which is very wild and free, and they have to go out and earn their own keep in the world. If ordered to study just one bird of prey for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Oh gosh, this is always really hard because I've had some pretty awesome intimate experiences with several species. These days, the birds that I'm hoping I'll get to monitor for a long time are the peregrine falcon. This is the bird species that went through a pretty steep decline in the 20th century. And then our group, the Predatory Bird Research Group, was one of the main partners bringing them back into North America. So we've been monitoring that species for a few decades now, and hopefully we'll continue to for several decades.
What is it that you find so attractive about the bird itself, though?
These birds, well, first of all, no other raptor has a superlative for the entire animal kingdom. Peregrine falcons are the fastest species on Earth. They can fly at speeds over 200 miles per hour when they're in a stoop hunting those pigeons.
And that's a superlative.
Yes.
Unmatched.
Unmatched.
Okay.
But they're beautiful. I mean, these birds, not only do they have just like a pretty striking appearance with their slate backs and hoods and, you know, very sort of delicately barred undersides, but they also have really shown themselves to be super resilient and adaptable. And we can find them not only in these wild, untamed places, but in the middle of our cities. So they've really become a bird that can live with us.
I always like to ask people about their origin story. So one day a peregrine landed on your head and you decided I'm going to become a bird researcher. How did you find yourself in the world of predatory birds?
Yeah, so I found out that one could find work walking around outside and listening to birds at some point in the end of my college career at UC Davis, and I decided I definitely want to do that. But soon after that, I got to take a raptor biology class at UC Davis, fell in love with the topic, went to work at the Golden Gate Raptor Observatory studying the migration that occurs in the Bay Area each fall. And pretty much after that, I was hooked. I also have a background in toxicology, heavy metal toxicology. So when I learned that the California condor had a lot of issues, a lot of hurdles to their recovery based on lead poisoning, that's when I really zeroed in on what I was going to be studying for my graduate degree.
So you got two different expert fields of expertise that Correct. Worked themselves right together.
Exactly.
And there you were, a little bit of serendipity.
Yeah.
So Carl Linnaeus divided up the birds of prey into four different fields. And yep. I thought it would be fun to have a tour, a guided tour from somebody who really knows. So let's start with the, who was Linnaeus and how did he divide things up, by the way?
Yeah, so Carl Linnaeus did a pretty good job using form to try to separate and sort of track the relatedness of species, sort of tree of life that we've come to understand of how species have evolved from common ancestors. He did a pretty good job, but we have learned that, at least for raptors, that there were some groups that have, you know, had to be morphed and changed once we got genetics in the mix and we can really get a better handle on how things came to be. One example is in the vulture group. Mm-hmm. We've got vultures in the old world. They're so like Eurasian vultures and African vultures. And then we've got our new world vultures, and they look very similar. They've both got bear heads. They are scavengers.
Right.
They're large, dark,
when
often.
When you say new world, is that us?
Us here in North America okay. and South America, yeah. And Central America. And so it turns out those actually convergently evolved to have similar features, but they are not as closely related as we thought.
Wow.
And so our new world vultures have their own family now, whereas the old world vultures are with the eagles and hawks and all
okay.
of that. Yeah.
So, and vultures is one of the groups that Linnaeus divided things up to. The
yep.
others, eagles, hawks, and falcons.
Yep. And so that's another fun one, another split that occurred relatively recently. It appears falcons are actually more related to birds like parrots than the other
really?
Hawks and eagles. And so we see that in the way they molt their feathers and some other behaviors that they perform. And so they've become their own family as well now, falcons. But the eagles and hawks, other as we call diurnal raptors, so they're active during the day, and they share a lot of natural history features, as they do with all other raptors, but things like that sharp eyesight, the grasping feet and claws for capturing their live prey, and often that hooked bill for, you know, ripping up their
prey.
And
they're always attacking something that's big.
Yeah.
Relative to their size, too?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, it depends on the size of the hawk, what their prey is going to be. They definitely all have their own niche. And we do have raptors that eat things like insects, you know, that might not be as big comparative to their body size. But then there's the extremes where we have, you know, golden eagles
right.
taking down or going wolf hunting with their
right.
falconers and
right.
things like that. Yeah.
It's something you see in videos of Mongolia or something
yeah.
like that. Incredible videos. Yeah.
Amazing. Yeah.
And then owls.
Yep, owls are raptors too. Right, even though they're active too. During the night, they share a lot of those same characteristics I just mentioned. Of course, they've adapted to also use sound to hunt because there's not it's pretty low light situation at night, and right. so they utilize.
So we, sound. Can they hear a mouse squeaking or something
squeaking,
like that?
Squeaking, moving around through the brush. They've got great hearing, and to sort of avoid. The interference that might occur from their flying about and movements, they've actually got incredibly silent flight as well as another thing unique mm-hmm. to owls.
What predates on owls? Because I noticed mm. that owls have a great sense of camouflage. They're always, yes. they always seem to be hiding. So what predates on them, I wonder?
You know, there are definitely instances of raptor-on-raptor predation, so we could see diurnal raptors taking owls when they're not awake, mm-hmm. and vice versa. We also see larger owls eating smaller owls. But yeah, in general, raptors, a lot of raptors are relatively predator-free. So like the right. California condor, unless they're nestlings.
That would make them apex less, predators,
they
right?
Are, yeah, they are mostly apex predators, yeah.
Which means they have no predators predating on them, which yes. is a good deal. Now, yeah. shrikes. I'm not sure what a shrike is.
They're raptor adjacent. Yeah, they are like sort of one of those birds that's on their way to convergently evolving to a raptor-like bird. They are found here in California. I've definitely seen them out more in the central California area. And what they tend to do is they'll pick up, you know, little insects and... They're actually in the songbird family, I believe. Okay. But they'll pick up little insects, reptiles and things, and small rodents, and they will use thorns on cactus, or actually nowadays more likely barbed wire fences, and stab their prey on those, and then consume them.
And one of the things that I thought of asking is, aren't all birds predators of something or other?
Yeah.
It gets right down to it.
There are a lot of birds that exhibit predatory behavior. So if you think about all the fish-eating birds mm-hmm. out in the ocean behind us, we've got...
I was thinking even parrots. You know.
Yep, insectivores, all the songbirds that eat insects. So that's why we have the term raptor. Ornithologists have decided to group this specific group of predatory birds into this sort of basket term because they have a lot of similar natural history traits. And so they have a lot of the same foraging behaviors, a lot of the same habitat requirements, those kinds of things. And they use their feet to grab their prey, whereas a lot of these other predatory birds we're talking about, fish eaters, insectivores, they're going to grab stuff with their bills.
So there you are. And which one's your favorite?
My personal favorite. I say something different every time just to spread the love around. So I recently said American kestrels because they really do light up my day when I see them. But I think today I'm going to give some love to the northern harrier, which is a sort of unique genus we have or a unique species we have here in the northern hemisphere that... courses low over coastal marshes and tends to prey on voles.
There you go, folks. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dr. Zeka Glucks, Director of Predatory Bird Research Group, University of California, Santa Cruz. Right back. We're talking about birds, all those predators in nature. Stay tuned.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Michael Olson. Today we're talking about predatory birds, which essentially, I think all birds are predatory or to one extent or another. But it's those birds that go after other birds and other animals that we love to watch for some reason. And then I just think of whenever I see a red-tailed hawk soaring in a thermal, I just stop and I watch. And there's just something about that incredible freedom that bird is having, is riding on the wind, climbing up, looking for dinner someplace along the line. We're with Dr. Zeka Gluck, who is the director, my goodness, a director of the University of California Predatory Bird Research Center at the University of California. And you mentioned that you were part of an organization that helped bring back the peregrine falcon.
Yeah.
And we've had some trouble with our predatory birds in civilization, and there's all kinds of reasons why, but we seem to be taking them under our wing, as it were, and doing what we can to bring them back. And I thought it would be fun to talk about some of them. Let's start with the condor, which is a spectacular critter when it's flying. It's just magnificent. I once had the opportunity to officiate at a wedding up on top of a mountain in the Big Sur.
Mm-hmm.
And there they were, just soaring right along next to us. It was
what
awesome.
A blessing. Yeah, I mean, that's awesome. That's a great happening.
So part of your training was in toxicology. So mm-hmm. you're studying poisons.
Yep, contaminants in the environment and mm-hmm. where they come from and where they go.
So how did you become fascinated with toxicology anyway?
Oh man, so that's a pretty early origin story. I grew up in Santa Cruz, California. Mm-hmm. So here where we are, and there used to be a program where high school students could apply early to the UC, and they could take classes at the UC Santa Cruz. And so I did that, and I got the opportunity to take an environmental toxicology class in the brand new environmental toxicology department up there. And I just got my mind blown. It was the first time I'd ever heard of all of the contamination issues our planet is facing, threats to fresh water, you know, the unprecedented human population growth that's occurring. And I just got really turned on to environmental science.
Well, isn't the unprecedented growth of the human population probably problem number one with everything?
Yeah, you know, it is something that we could all learn to reduce our footprint and it wouldn't be as big of an issue. But since we're the main culprits in contamination of the environment, the more of us there are, we tend to just increase that contamination, unfortunately, or that pollution. But yeah, after that class, I really just kept on that course. And when I got into raptors, when I got into predatory birds, I discovered that time after time, the thing that started their populations declining was an environmental contaminant. Mm-hmm. And so, as we said, since they sit at the top of the food chain, they're apex predators, they're particularly vulnerable to environmental contaminants.
Well, let's look at the condor, which, of course, is a vulture,
mm-hmm.
a magnificent vulture, which feeds on carrion. And what is in the carrion that got in the Gulf and the condors?
Yeah, okay. Well, they are a apex scavenger. And so really anything that gets into the food chain, they are potentially going to encounter. And since they're both terrestrial scavengers, you know, the terrestrial mammals, they're, and also marine scavengers, because they eat beach cast mammals on our beaches, like whales and sea lions that wash up. They are vulnerable to both food chain contamination. So we see things like, you know, the remnants of DDT in these birds. They do
still,
it's just taking its time. It's such a persistent chemical. We see other marine contaminants like mercury and other contaminants, but they particularly have been having issues with lead poisoning from the terrestrial side, and
And where do they get lead?
And because they're scavengers and they tend to eat things that are already dead, mm-hmm. Often these animals are, since we're the main predators these days, shot with lead-based ammunition, okay. Which is the traditional or, you know, long-time compound we've always used.
Put in bullets.
Exactly.
Lead.
Yep.
Because
yep.
it has weight and, yeah.
It's easy to form into shapes, and it's got weight. And when it hits an animal, it breaks apart into a bunch of tiny pieces. It's frangible is the word for that. And what that does is it creates all these different little wound channels, which is great if you're trying to hit vital organs, but not great if you don't want to eat little bits of lead when you're consuming that animal. And so condors are very social feeders. They'll all eat together on a carcass. So even if just one carcass has lead in it, we get a lot of different birds getting poisoned.
And how much lead does it take to make a difference?
To make a difference in the organism, yeah. like to hurt the bird. Yeah, so we've had situations where we've found fragments smaller than a fingernail clipping that has killed a California condor. So it doesn't take much.
Wow.
Lead's a very toxic metal.
And of course, there are many years of hunting.
Yes.
That I think of the pig hunters of the California coast, mm-hmm. and a lot of those pigs, wild pigs, probably don't get picked up, and they
right.
folks
that are doing you know, that kind of species removal, pest removal, ground squirrels, and, you know, sometimes people are shooting animals that they don't intend to, you know, put on the dinner table,
right,
and so those are often left out to be scavenged.
And so fingernails, not very much, no. I mean, very, very little.
Yeah.
So what was the situation with respect to our condors? I know that we've been doing a lot of work to try to bring them back.
Yeah, they're still a critically endangered species, so there is a, you know, vibrant recovery program effort going throughout the Western U.S., at several different release sites, several different recovery, you know, sort of groups are working on this. And unfortunately, mortality is still as high as it's ever been for California condors when it comes to lead poisoning. But we are at least seeing them reproduce successfully in the wild. So they do have some buffer for that mortality effect now. We have, gosh, over 500 birds in existence, and about half of those birds are free flying in the wild these days. Wow. So when you think of where they were back in the 1980s.
Where were they?
1980s, they were down. We only had a few left in Southern California. And ultimately, when they were all brought into captivity, there were only 22 birds left in existence.
Wow.
So through captive breeding, reintroduction, and other, you know, efforts to make the world safer for them, they've been able to really come back, which is exciting.
Well, one of the things I know we've done is change the nature of our ammunition.
Yes, yeah. We are definitely seeing an expansion of non-toxic options. Often these are copper, steel, bismuth, other kinds of alloys. Certainly, folks have to do some work to utilize these kinds of ammunition. They've got to recite their rifles, kind of get used to the new, you know, way things, the ballistics of everything.
They don't quite fly the same
way. Exactly. Got to recite, got to retarget that in. But once people switch, there's really great reviews on the quality and performance of these other kinds of ammunition.
And then we get to have what other birds are impacted to the extent with lead that to the extent that condors are?
Well, condors have certainly been the flagship, and they seem to be, you know, the most
impactive. Is it because they're the biggest and the most magnificent?
Yeah, and they really experienced the most, you know, population decline from it. Mm-hmm. Probably because there's very few of them. They're very long-lived, and because of that, it takes them a while to reach sexual maturity. They've got a low reproductive rate, one chick every other year after they reach 7 years old.
Wow.
So compared to other raptors, they just don't bounce back from lead poisoning as well. But research is showing, actually up at UC Santa Cruz, there's a toxicology lab, the Finkelstein lab. They've been doing continued work on lead poisoning and wildlife, and have found that golden and bald eagles are experiencing very high frequency of lead poisoning. We just haven't detected it in the same way because we don't study them as closely as California condors.
Now, I note that golden eagle is the Mexico's national bird.
Yes.
And there's like only 100 of them left in the entire country or something.
Oh, wow.
Incredible like that.
I believe
that. So the predatory birds are under a lot of pressure just about everywhere, aren't they?
Yeah. Yeah. There's different impacts in each, you know, culture. But certainly, you know, if there's a compound being used that's toxic to raptors, it'll probably find its way to them. Often, you know, I'm heartened by the fact that often it's not intentional. Often it's just a secondary poisoning for some other use people are using these compounds for. Luckily, people aren't trying to hurt raptors,
right,
but they do ultimately end up being the victim.
And I guess one of the principal examples of that would be in rodenticides.
These days, yeah, rodenticides are the emerging contaminant of concern for a lot of raptor species in North America.
So what we see the rats, we feed the rats poison, the rats die, the rats are eaten by other critters,
yep. And
it goes right up the food chain then.
That's how it works, yeah. They basically, the way that a lot of these, at least these anticoagulant rodenticides work, which are pretty popular amongst consumers and also pest control, you know, businesses. They work by, you know, slowly over time killing these pest species, these rodents, and then it kind of weakens them and makes them maybe even more likely to be picked up by a predator because they're out in the open, they're not feeling good, and then it's just a direct poison punch to that predator, be it a predatory bird or a bobcat or a mountain lion, they end up passing that poison on.
Okay. Let's move on to the peregrine, which is the most beautiful and the fastest bird on the face of the earth.
Sure is.
And one of the more fascinating things with respect to helping it recover is that it seems like we taught it to live in town. Did we really do that, or?
We provided homes for it to live in town. Uh-huh. So basically, there didn't used to be these skyscrapers in the Bay Area. There didn't used to be these sort of urban canyons and cliffs for them to utilize. So they were basically limited to places that had cliffs with potholes that they could nest in. And now all of a sudden they've got these bridges and cranes and buildings. And so they saw this area and said, you know what, this looks just like home. And they decided to move in. And so once the buildings were available, they made it.
They're just like people then.
Yeah.
Hey, look at this. We can live in San Francisco.
Yeah, great views.
Great views. Everything is here. What do they eat?
Oh, well, in the cities, especially in the Bay Area, they've got an awesome prey base. But in cities in general, we've got our rock pigeon population, ubiquitous usually. Yep. There's always also blackbird species live urban areas. These are great prey species for peregrines. But here in the Bay, they've also got access to shorebirds and seabirds, and it's just a plethora of food sources.
So it's good eating for peregrines in the Bay Area.
Yes.
And they're everywhere, aren't they, peregrines? Or are they spread throughout the United States?
Except for, you know, Antarctica, I believe. Yeah. But yeah, they are one of those species that's the same species found around the planet. There's different subspecies and things like that. But because they migrate so far, they can travel so far, they can travel over water, there's still gene flow between all these populations around the world.
So they get around.
Yeah.
Wow.
The peregrine means the wanderer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so when did we discover that they were endangered then?
So ornithologists, you know, and falconers had noticed that there had been a steep decline in the early 20th century or mid-20th century. And it became very, very clear and very quickly that there were no peregrine falcons left east of the Mississippi once they started really trying to look for nest sites.
None?
No nest sites, at least. They might have seen one here and there. And so, you know, people began in earnest to try to figure out how many were left in the U.S. and what was going on. So we still had a few birds out here. And by 1970, we had only two nests left in California here. But it became clear that what was going on is there was basically
Total collapse.
It's pretty close to total. I mean, we are very lucky that that was able to be arrested as quickly
at
as
that
it was.
Point, yeah.
But yeah, what was lucky is that there was just a lot of focus from the academy on this problem. And
which academy again?
Oh, just, you know, scientists in general.
Oh, okay.
And so with all of that focus, they were able to determine very quickly that DDT, a pesticide that had just come into very popular use after post-World War II, was causing eggshell thinning and breakage. And so they weren't making any new baby peregrines. And so it was just a really lucky timing of the whole thing.
Rachel Carson
was, you know, one of the first folks that popularized this issue. So there was political will. We had the Endangered Species Act that went into effect in the early 70s. Also, the EPA was became an agency at the same time. And so with this newfound, you know, funding, political power, you know, pathways to create this good environment for conservation, we're able not only to ban the pesticide almost as soon as we discovered it was an issue, but also start captive breeding programs. And those two things together really boosted the population, and it was fully recovered by the late 90s. The species.
They were fast breeders.
Though. Yeah. Well, yeah. Actually, peregrine falcons do something really great called double clutching or even triple clutching. So if their eggs are removed early enough in the breeding cycle, they'll lay another clutch. Ah. So you could have one female make, you know, 8-12 babies in a year.
And so if you're captive breeding, you can get a regular factory going.
Absolutely. But then you end up with a lot of babies. So what do you do with them? Mm-hmm. We didn't have many adults to foster them out to. So they would do this process where they would, you'd have a human attendant at these hack sites, it was called, these little boxes they'd put the babies in together.
And they have little mittens and stuff.
They didn't do the little puppet thing quite yet, but they would basically have a little feeding tube, a little PVC pipe. They would put little quails down into, so they wouldn't see the humans feeding them, but they'd be feeding the birds. And when they opened the box, they'd continue to provide that food supplement as they learned how to hunt on their own. And wow. These young birds, it's you know, innate. They were able to learn how to hunt without a parent teaching them.
Okay, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dr. Zeka Glux. And you, we're going to be right back. And we're going to talk about what we, the people, can do to better foster the civilizations of these magnificent birds right back.
Duke the Pug will soon turn 20, which is pretty good for a dog breed that averages 11 years. When Duke was 13, he lost a lot of hair, had a hard time getting up for a walk, and his bowel movements were not very moving. We started making his food instead of buying it. We cook up a big batch of rice, chicken, broccoli, carrots, and turmeric, freeze meal-sized batches, and thaw them at mealtime. We also sprinkle Arthrodex on each meal. Arthrodex is a complete blend of plant-derived minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and enzymes formulated to make old dogs young again. And it does. Duke the Pug does have his problems, but he has all his hair, loves daily walks, and has no problems with his movements. Breakfast is at 7, and if it's not there by 7:01, we all hear about it. Make your old dog young again. Pick up Arthrodex at NutriensToGo.com. And while you're at it, make yourself young again with a Healthy Body Start Pack. NutriensToGo.com. NutriensToGo.com.
Business owners, get money you need in 2 to 3 days at BusinessMoneyToGo.com. Business Money To Go is a network of reputable small business lenders that compete to lend you money. When you qualify with a one-page application, Business Money To Go will get you the best loan at the best rate in 2 to 3 days. Get $5,000 to $500,000 in 2 to 3 days at BusinessMoneyToGo.com. BusinessMoneyToGo.com.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers, for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think certified American-grown flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
So much to say, so little time to say it. On the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Yes, so much to say and so little time to say it. We're talking about predatory birds. Those are the birds that, you know, make us stop and look and think, oh, what a magnificent bird that is. And maybe even wish we could be that free. Who knows? You know, that's kind of what I think when I see those red-tailed hawks orbiting about on a thermal. I think, my goodness, that looks great. So we're with Dr. Zeka Glucks, who has been working on this issue of predatory birds for quite a while. Not too long.
You know, it's actually, I was just looking back, it's been about maybe 12 years since my first doctor job.
Okay, so that's pretty
been
good.
Been in the world.
Uh-huh. And UC has had a program going up there for quite some time, hasn't it?
Yeah, since 1975.
Now, we're working with birds almost everywhere in the world. It seems like there are so many different organizations that are working with birds, trying to do what we can to help them hang around and strengthen their communities. Where do we start?
Yeah, so we've definitely found that birds are excellent indicators of healthy ecosystems, and they're also easy to see and hear, and that's why we study them. You know, they're pretty well studied because of that. And often, you know, it comes down to things like, for all bird species, preserving their habitat, places where they can find food and places to nest. And then, of course, as we've talked about with raptors, but also for other birds, reducing impacts that we have on them, either knowingly or unknowingly. So that could be things like contaminants, or even things like road strikes and other kinds of collisions, window strikes.
And habitats, you know, preservation is not just an issue with respect to predatory birds, but with also other predators as well.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a grizzly bear, what do you do? And that would seem like the birds have a little advantage over other predators when it gets right down to it, because they can move around. And yet it is an issue, losing forests, unless you're a peregrine. You just move into town with everybody else.
Yeah, it depends on your prey base and what you need to nest, for sure. I think that raptors and scavengers are a great group to preserve, because, as you say, they're able to handle these habitat, you know, mosaics that we've created with our human civilizations, and kind of just go over habitat that doesn't suit them, and then find their habitat where they can. And so we're really lucky to still have them doing so well around performing all these ecosystem services like pest control, like removal
Tell
of
us
dead
about
animals.
The extent to which they provide this service to this community. I know that there are a lot of farmers in this area who have taken to bringing them into their farms.
Yeah. So, think of it as bringing into the farms, or really just creating areas for them that make it easier for them to forage. Things like putting up perches, or for cavity nesters, putting up nest boxes for different kinds of species that require that to reproduce. We've found that encouraging native predators, be it, you know, insectivores, if you have a crop that has insect pests, or our predatory birds, if you have crops that have rodent pests, can actually really reduce, you know, the inputs you have to put in. They do the job for you. Yeah.
And they're nice to have around too.
While you're out there, you want to see some wildlife, of course.
There you go. And there are people in this area who are actually very active in bringing songbirds and regular birds just back to the farm fields.
Absolutely.
So there's two different populations there, one trying to get rid of everything and the other trying to bring them back. So it's an interesting conflict to watch develop. Studying, and you mentioned studying. How do we go about actually studying predators? That's what you do.
Yeah. So
what do you do?
It's a lot of sitting and watching, you know. We're very lucky. We are a mostly sort of community science supported organization. So we've got a lot of volunteers out there that are collecting data for us at different nest sites.
What do you mean data? What do they do?
Oh, you know, watching birds out there perform their you know, breeding behaviors. Mm-hmm. So waiting to see if there's going to be food brought into a nest, if there's someone sitting on eggs, how many babies come out of that nest. This kind of work takes hours and hours of commitment, and so it can be very expensive. But we've got a lot of, like, as you say, this community is really invested in raptor conservation, so we have a lot of folks that are willing to put in this time, volunteer.
Sounds like kind of fun.
Yeah, you know, there are benefits. There definitely are benefits, but non-monetary ones.
So, yeah, and when you do watch, mm-hmm. you become part of that community too, don't you?
Absolutely.
You become kind of a warrior.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of friendships that have formed through this kind of work. And I would say just with any kind of wildlife observation, it's good for the soul. Right. It's good for the mind.
And one of the big tools that you have to really bring populations back, of course, is the catch and breeding programs and you release them. Did you participate that with respect to the condor?
Yeah, so I joined the California Condor Recovery Program as an intern in 2011. And I was in the field crew, so I was out there monitoring birds, making sure they were healthy, trapping them for health checks. They all carry tracking equipment, so you could use radio antennas to find the birds. Okay. Exactly. But also when birds were sick, we would have to transport them to zoos to get treated for lead poisoning. And also those captively bred birds we would release to the wild from time to time.
So which is the reward.
Yeah. Right. So I worked with some of those folks that were working on that aspect of the program. And they really are the real heroes, the zoos that are doing the captive breeding and also clinical treatment of birds, because they're doing some of the hardest parts, I would say. Yeah.
Most time consuming, most.
And heartbreaking when you see a bird die that you raised from an egg, you know, that's rough. Yeah.
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 And then educating, it would seem to be a big part of what it's going to take to make all of this work. Yeah. You're going to have to reach out into the general population and let people know. It seems like we've been doing a pretty good job with that with respect to a lot of the videos you see and whatnot.
Good, yeah.
And so is that part of what your program consists of as well?
It's a big part.
Dr. Zika out there.
It's a big part, yeah. No, that is actually, you know, one of the main tenets of our organization is doing the outreach. And you know, our community science program in itself is an educational program because we're training folks to learn and care about raptors. We also have undergraduates that are learning how to be the next, you know, the next conservation leaders, getting them the tools that they need to succeed as scientists. And then of course, doing outreach in the community and making sure not only that folks are thinking of the impacts today, but remembering the success stories like the peregrine falcon, so we don't lose hope when we're seeing species decline.
Are there any other peregrine falcon stories hanging around?
Oh, man. So, yeah. Well, the most recent one we were just talking about is we have a few nests that have cameras on them that anyone can watch. One is managed by UC Berkeley. And they're just, like every peregrine falcon nest, it's a soap opera. Every year, there's interlopers, there's, you know, injuries, there's chicks that do odd things when they fledge. But this year, just recently, we had the female Annie, who's been there since the beginning, great mom, just disappear for a week. Her husband, her mate, was hanging around. There were other birds showing up. He was courting them. We had figured Annie was gone for good. We started our mourning process. The folks that run that program shared with the public that Annie was no longer. And then the next day she showed back up like nothing had happened, sitting on the at the nest site, just ready to start breeding. And so now she's back. She's the female of that site. And this is the kind of stuff that's happening. It can be really heartbreaking.
It's really
that
funny
happens all
when
the time.
Dr. Zika came to the radio station here and I introduced her to the staff. everybody started talking about that story.
Yeah, yeah. We all know and love him now.
So it's like, gosh, it's better than a soap opera.
It really is. Yeah, I really encourage everyone to check out Cal Falcons. There's Instagram, there's Facebook, there's a live streaming camera online, and it's a really great way to see get that intimate look into Peregrine Falcon family life.
Mm-hmm. Are they doing this elsewhere in the United States? I ran across something that said Pennsylvania is a great raptor state.
Oh yeah, there's other flyways that are great for researching raptors. A lot of times the best way to count raptors is when they're all together in one place, because unlike other birds, they're really sort of disparately distributed. They need a lot of land, so it's hard to go count them all. But on migration, they're all going the same direction. And there's some places where there's little like mountain ranges, or in the case of the Bay Area, peninsulas and things that will funnel them through a space. Mm-hmm. And so out in Pennsylvania, there's a site like this too, where you can just count the birds as they come through. And so then year to year, over many years, you can catch all these trends that are occurring and try to determine why they are occurring before it's too late.
Good. Are there any other rescues like the rescue of the peregrine?
Well, and, of course, the California condors is our current version of that. But one other success story I could highlight is with the Swainson's hawk, which is a Central California raptor that migrates all the way down to Argentina in the wintertime. And we had seen that they had really reduced in population, and it was unclear why. But turned on their wintering grounds, they were being exposed to a pesticide that's a neurotoxin called monocrotophos. They're insectivorous raptors in the wintertime. So they were eating that and just dying in large numbers. And it was found quickly enough, thanks to things like satellite tracking and figuring out where they were, that they were able to stop the use of that pesticide down in the Pampas in Argentina, and the birds have recovered, gratefully.
We use a lot of pesticides still.
We do, yeah.
And how do the birds escape that? It's in the food chain. It's everywhere. You know, it's affecting a lot of different mammals.
Yeah. I mean, what it comes down to, especially with a lot of environmental contaminants, is the sort of compounding of sublethal effects. So sometimes pesticides aren't quite as deadly as monocrotophos or quite as reproductively toxic as DDT, but it's probably having some impact. And then when you combine that with things like drought or, you know, climate change, right, habitat loss, it can really start to really add up for the birds and become a problem. And one example of this, one of these kinds of hard to grasp declines that's happening right now, is in the American kestrel, our smallest North American falcon, which eats insects and rodents. So it's got a lot of potential impacts, but we don't know exactly why.
Those
its population.
Those are the ones you see zooming.
Yeah, they zoom about. They hover up really. They hover in the sky. They're really brightly colored. They're oranges and blues. They're beautiful birds, and they're quite common. You know, we consider them a common bird, but they've been declining over the past few decades. And it's just, we're not sure exactly why. If it's climate change, pesticides, habitat loss, or some combination of that. Yeah.
Are there any birds you don't like?
Oh man, I don't think so. yeah, you know, I have a soft space in my heart. So even if there's a bird doing damage in my yard or making loud noises, I usually give them the benefit of the doubt.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you even like crows?
Oh, you know, I'm one of those weirdos. I love all corvids, the crow family.
Corvid family, yeah.
Yeah, I think that they're fascinating. They've got really, really strong personalities, and they're more like us, I think, than most
Too
birds.
Too much like us.
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. We're projecting, and we just can't handle seeing ourselves.
Way too much like us, yeah.
Reflecting back.
So I've done a number of shows about the corvid family, and the crows are always up there for being very, very interesting. And yes, they have memories.
Yes.
And they plot against you.
Oh,
too.
they can have, yes, vendettas.
Yeah. Now, what about crows and predatory birds? Because I've seen them chase away red-tailed hawks all the time.
One of the best ways to find a predatory bird out in the wild is for looking for those corvids that are making lots of noise, because they do something called mobbing, where they, I mean, a lot of other bird species do this, but corvids are the loudest at it. And they, if they see something that they don't want in their territory, they don't want, you know, a predatory bird that might eat their babies or something right. like that, they will take it upon themselves to mob that raptor and, you know, basically haze it away.
Yeah.
And it tends to work, even though the raptor has better tools. They usually get annoyed enough to move away.
Okay, I'm leaving.
Yeah.
I'm leaving.
Yeah.
Dr. Zikazuk, what can we do as people out here in the world to help to the extent that we can help? What can we do? How do we get involved
in
the world of predatory birds?
I think the first step is just to notice them. You know, notice them in your neighborhood, what they're doing. Just get to know them, because then you can prevent things like unintentional nest destruction or, you know, utilizing compounds like rodenticides that, you know, might impact the birds in your neighborhood. So just get to know them. Start looking up, looking for raptors.
Look up.
Yep. That up. Tends to be where they are.
Look for squawking crows.
Yeah.
Okay. Where are you going next?
Oh man, I hope I'm here at the Predatory Bird Group for some time. I really enjoy the opportunity to both teach and perform research. But with our work, we've been really delving in more to the raptors as rodent control world. Go. And so we'll hope to be exploring this more as we go.
Dr. Zikazuk, thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain Radio program, and stay tuned. Hey, keep your eyes up in the sky and find those predatory birds and say hello to them. Thank you all for tuning in.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.